little practice, are we doing? That's funny.
The Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals, in for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all of you. The first case for argument this morning is administered by Walmart, Mr. Dunn.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is an appeal from a preliminary injunction granted by Judge Lefko, barring proceeding in the state court and barring the disbursement of or the spending of certain settlement funds. The injunction, we'd like to point out, entered by Judge Lefko is not an order imposing a constructive trust on any funds. It is merely a injunction barring the defendants from disposing of certain portions of the monies in their possession, or more appropriately, in the possession of the plaintiff, the defendant, Clara Barkle. The plaintiff here attempts to manufacture jurisdiction so that it will not have to pay attorney's fees on a portion of those funds under Illinois law. While the case was pending, the Supreme Court decided the case of Great West versus Knutson, which I inadvertently kept citing as Great Western, and I apologize to the court for that. In that case, the Supreme Court held that suits for reimbursement by ERISA plans, such as this one, are not equitable, and that the federal courts do not have jurisdiction to hear these cases under Section 502A of ERISA.
But this isn't such as this one. In this case,
I don't think so, Judge. I think this is a case where they're seeking reimbursement of funds. That's all they're doing. There is some dicta where they talk about maybe they could go after someone who's in possession of the funds, and I'll address that in a second. But the fact that the funds are dispersed, it really is, in my mind, as a practicing plaintiff's lawyer in these cases, doesn't make any difference, because the reality is, in every case where a plaintiff settles a case, the funds are dispersed through the attorney's trust fund account. So that if this court decides that a constructive trust can be imposed upon a settlement fund such as this, what you're going to have is a total gutting of the rationale and the decision in Knutson. The reality is that, and you see it, and I just was shepherdizing the case yesterday, there's a case that was decided on August 22nd, and I filed a letter today, called Primax versus Carey, where the ERISA plan sought to impose a constructive trust on a settlement not yet made, where there was just a state court case pending. And if we look at the rationale behind Knutson, is that... I think the Supreme Court is saying in Knutson, we don't want the federal courts burdened, and we don't believe that the Congress decided that the federal district court should be burdened with these types of actions. And the reality is, the practical effect of it is that you're going to have two lawsuits in every case where a person is injured and the ERISA plans pay funds. And if that's what this court decides, then that's the case. But in reality, because settlement funds must be transferred or or dispersed through the lawyer's escrow account, then if you say that a constructive trust can be imposed upon those funds, the reality is that you're setting up a gutting of the rationale behind Knutson. That's number one. Number well, it's 18 actually, but no. I'm sorry. May I correct you? The original complaint was filed for $34,000. More than 10 months before the original complaint was filed, they paid out only $18,000, so that they filed a complaint based on a false affidavit. The original, the actual amount apparently is $18,000 and change. So. That's correct, and then we no, we have not settled. That's correct.
But the point is that was set aside and other amounts.
That's correct. And the defendant in this case, the plaintiff, personal injury plaintiff, held those funds available until the court could decide the issue of whether or not I could make a claim for attorney's fees under the common fund doctrine. But you see, even if you look at that, even if you look at the constructive trust language, if you look at Dobbs, the treatise on constructive trust, it talks about on page 597, and Dobbs is really the only place I could go to look to find it, the notion that the defendant has legal title, but the plaintiff has a superior moral or equitable claim. It proceeds from the notion that the plaintiff has a superior moral or equitable claim. So what you have to do, and I think what Knutson said you have to do, is you have to look at the basis of the underlying complaint. And the basis of this complaint is not that they have a superior moral or equitable claim. The basis of the complaint is contractual in nature, because they don't create in themselves an assignment. They don't create, like was set up in Knutson, a lien. All they create under their contractual ERISA plan is a right to claim or a right of reimbursement. They don't create a separate moral or equitable claim in those funds at all. All they have is a contractual right, and that's what they alleged in their complaint. The damages that they sought in their complaint are $34,000 and change, and now it's amended to $18,000 and change. They don't create any superior moral right, so they're not entitled to a constructive trust under this case. Well, but it has been dispersed. It's in an account owned by the defendant. It's in an account which the defendant has granted, earmarked for payment of any judgment. You know, what the plaintiff seeks to do here is get around the requirements of Rule 64, which this court can take judicial notice of. That Rule 64 provides for a prejudgment attachment, which he could have the same benefit if he can establish and plead and establish the facts required under Rule 64, and that's a legal remedy. Well, the Illinois court has decided that clause talks only and goes only to the issue of attorney's fees of the plaintiff. And that a claim under the Common Fund Doctrine, and I think under the Boeing case in the Common Fund, the Federal Common Fund Doctrine, the claim for attorney's fees is a claim that's the right of the attorney, not the right of the client. And the plan does not mention anything or say anything with reference to whether or not the participant of the plan must pay the plan's attorney's fees. Nowhere in the plan does it say that. Well, in practicality, the reality is that I see I'm going into my rebuttal time, and I know counsel, co-counsel wants to. I lost track of my thought. The reality is that it gets taken care of in a wash. You sit down with your client and you explain to him what the situation is, and there won't be any double billing for the plaintiff's attorney, which seems to be, well, is one of the arguments of the defendant. But that's something that I, as a plaintiff's attorney, sit down and discuss with my client and take care of. If I get credit for attorney's fees on that sum, I don't charge my client attorney's fees on the whole amount. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, my name is Howard Brinton. I represent Mr. Dunford directly. I joined in his brief, and I also join in his oral argument. I have very little to say, except I want to make a factual matter clear, and that is Mr. Dunford has done nothing wrong here. He was not under any court order not to disperse the funds. He was under a court order of Judge O'Malley in the circuit court to disperse the funds before this first case was filed. He was not added as a defendant in this case until after the funds had been dispersed. I want to point out that the funds are now in the possession of Clara Varco. And I wish, finally, on the issue of jurisdiction, to point out that Mr. Dunford is not a plan participant or a fiduciary, and he doesn't have the funds, and I don't know why he's here, both jurisdictionally and otherwise. Now, if the Court has any questions, I'd be pleased to answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. A couple of factual points to clear up. Mr. Dunford said that the funds, that he held the funds available, or that Ms. Varco held the funds available in order to decide for this court or for the lower court to decide later what was going to happen and who was going to get those monies. Well, the only reason those funds are being held is because Judge Lefkoe entered the injunction. And just some brief history, because this is fairly fairly complicated procedurally of what went on below. This started in late December of 2001 when Mr. Dunford filed a petition to adjudicate liens in the state court, which was set for hearing on October 1. My firm, which represents Walmart, received a response a day or two before the hearing. Mr. Dunford went to the state court, and the court specifically did not rule upon whether the Walmart plan was entitled to its monies, and held that aside. We then removed the case to federal court. Mr. Dunford filed a motion to remand. While that motion for remand was pending, we filed an independent action, which was assigned to Judge Lefkoe. Judge Alicia, who the removed case had been assigned to, remanded the case. Sometime after the filing of our complaint, which was assigned to Judge Lefkoe, and after the case had been remanded, Mr. Dunford, during a telephone conversation with my partner, said that he really didn't, he wasn't going, something to the effect of, he wasn't going to go back to the state court to get a determination of our rights and wasn't going to wait around for the federal court. Your Honor, I believe it is in the record of the hearing before Judge Lefko. I don't, those facts were discussed and are not disputed. I don't believe Mr. Dunford will dispute that he told us that he was going to give those funds to his client. And so at that point we had no choice, and we didn't know about the Knudsen case yet, but I did know about this court's previous decisions in Administrative Committee versus Wells and Health Cost Controls versus Washington, which really both of those cases, as I stated in my brief, set up the same two-part test that I believe that the Supreme Court authorized in Knudsen in these situations, that number one, you better have the party before the court that controls the funds, and you better get a hold of those funds before they're dissipated, and then number two, the second part is, what do the terms of the plan say? So we immediately went to Judge Lefko and asked Judge Lefko to enter a restraining order requiring that those funds be held, which, as the court knows, she did. We then went back and asked that be converted into a preliminary injunction to require Mr. Dunford or Ms. Farco. It's still unclear to me to this day which of them or whether both of them control this account, which I believe is at Harris Trust Bank. Mr. Dunford says it's Ms. Farco, and I suppose if we received some paperwork to that effect, I could probably dismiss him out, but that's never been provided. And because after the Knudsen case came out, I was concerned and know how important it is to be sure you have the party before the court who actually controls the funds. At that point, Mr. Dunford decided, well, maybe it would be a good idea to go back into state court, because I think he was getting the feeling that Judge Lefko, like all the other federal courts who have looked at the common fund issue, was going to follow the terms of the plan, and was going to disagree with the Illinois Supreme Court in the Bishop case, and so he then went back to the state court. And at that point, we asked Judge Lefko, because she did have the preliminary injunction in place, to stay that proceeding and to allow us to get a final determination. In effect, that's not the way her order doesn't read expressly that. But I would certainly acknowledge that the ultimate effect is that the state court proceeding with respect to our rights was stayed pending a determination by Judge Lefko, because Judge Lefko she was the only judge who had actually taken control of these funds and said, no, you're not going to dissipate these funds. These funds are going to stay under the control of the court, and we're going to get a determination. One thing I want to address Mr. Dunford's stated concern that if this court affirms Knudsen and reaffirms its decisions in the Wells and Washington case on the ability of a court to impose a constructive trust over identifiable funds, that all of a sudden we're going to have horrible things. We're going to have two lawsuits in every case. Well, this procedure, the ability of plan fiduciaries to go into court and seek injunctions and seek to impose constructive trust, is not new. It's not new in this circuit. It might be new in the rest of the country after Knudsen, but in this circuit, again, since at least I believe the Washington case came out in 1999, but at least since 1999 with the Washington decision and the Administrative Committee versus Wells decision, it's been appropriate that if you're a plan fiduciary and you're seeking to come into court and enforce a reimbursement provision, first of all, under ERISA civil enforcement provision, exclusive jurisdiction is in federal court. And there's been no dispute that a plan fiduciary has the right to come into federal court and enforce those rights, even if there has been a prior determination. Now, there have been a couple of cases, Blackburn versus Sunstrand and Special versus Siebold, where this court has said that if you get served with a petition to adjudicate, you can't remove that case to federal court. But the courts have acknowledged, and I believe the Washington case was one of these situations where the plan tried to remove the case, it was remanded back, the plan fiduciary turned around and filed an action in federal court, under 1132A3, ERISA civil enforcement provision, and the court had no problem with that. And obviously, 3 years into this, we would certainly be able to tell if the wheels of justice in this circuit had come to a grinding halt, because ERISA plan fiduciaries were not left with situations where they didn't feel like the rights of their health plans were being enforced. And I'm going to be straight up about this. There's a real issue here, because many lawyers for health plans, like myself, have no confidence in many state courts to follow the law. The Supreme Court in Egelhoff versus Egelhoff said, if you have a state law, doesn't matter if it's a state law of general applicability, but if that state law is going to clash with the plan terms, it's preempted, period. Well, the Illinois Supreme Court in the Bishop versus Burgard case found an amazing way to disregard that, and it had done so previously in the Schultons versus in the Schultons case. And on page 29 of my brief, I have a block quote from Judge Reinhardt, where he explains, I think, very well the fallacy of the Illinois Supreme Court's decision. And so why wouldn't any plan fiduciary, and certainly me, do everything I can to get into federal court, where every federal judge, most recently in a case I handled, Judge Dara, find it almost a no-brainer that if your plan says you don't have to share in the attorney's fees, that you can't apply a state law that would contravene that plan term. I mean, that is a fundamental principle of ERISA preemption law, and is not a real difficult principle to get to. Yet the Illinois Supreme Court tortured the procedure of that case in order to find some way to avoid ERISA's preemption clause.
Well, then you come in under 50283.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I agree with that, Judge. If the money is gone and has been dissipated, then I think you're too late. I think it's in the record. It's in the record below, and I believe Mr. Dunford alluded to it, that the money has been segregated and is being held by Ms. Varco at Harris Trust Bank. Oh, I think it is. It's happening all. I think. Well, first of all, I think the plaintiff's bar has a problem, because Rule 1.14, the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct, I believe it's either 1.14 or 1.15, I apologize. Well, either 1.14 or 1.15, I believe, prohibit that sort of thing. As a matter of fact, Judge Lefkoe made a comment that at the end of this case, she and I both may have an obligation to report Mr. Dunford to the Illinois bar. Because she absolutely, it's in the record. Because you cannot disperse funds when you know about a third party claim. That's exactly what he did, and I'm having.
See, this is the point. They're not really dispersed, and they are put in a separate account. That's painful, a separate property. So that seems to achieve what
5023 I totally agree, but see, when I called Mr. Dunford, he wouldn't. I asked him, and I quote pretty extensively in my correspondence in my brief. I said, "Look, Mr. Dunford, just agree you're going to hold these monies, and we'll get the court to make a determination." And he wouldn't do it. It wasn't until we got to the preliminary injunction hearing that we found out that the monies had been set aside. And just a few minutes ago, he stood up and acted as if he had come forward and graciously agreed to set these monies aside. That's not what happened at all. The only reason these monies are safe, if you will, is because we went in and got the TRO and the injunction. Otherwise, they'd be gone. And that's exactly what 1132A3A, which allows expressly allows for an injunction, I think was meant for. And also, our complaint on final relief, not for preliminary injunction, on final relief, seeks a constructive trust and restitution, which Justice Scalia's opinion expressly authorized, in which this court expressly authorized previously in the Wells case and in the Washington case. In situations like this, where the funds are identifiable and where the plan terms specifically allow for the relief. A couple other points, and we've talked a lot about the merits today, but we truly are here on a preliminary injunction. And I believe Judge Lefkoe was well within her discretion on several different grounds to grant the injunction. First, 1132A3A, where you have a violation of a federal statute, expressly allows for an injunction. And the Illinois Bell case, which was decided by Judge Flom, certainly allows for that type of situation, which we have here, where there's been a violation of the terms of the plan, therefore a violation of the statute, and we went in and got the injunction to require that the funds be held. Even if, as in the Illinois Bell case, this court held that if you have a federal statute that expressly allows for an injunction, you don't even get to the Rule 65 factors. But even if you get to the Rule 65 factors, we have a strong likelihood of success. Not only is there no adequate remedy at law, there's no remedy at law, because the only relief that we have that we can seek is equitable relief under ERISA. So not only is there not an adequate remedy at law, there's none. Finally, there is irreparable harm, because if these funds are dissipated, as Justice Scalia indicated in Knutson, there is no way we can come into this court and get equitable relief. So even if you talk about the Rule 65 factors, Judge Lefkoe was well within her discretion. And finally, on the public interest aspect of this, I think Judge Posner said it so well back in the Cutting versus Jerome Foods case when he talked about the public interest in these situations. He said that every plan participant, and I know this to be true because we just had a friend who was in an auto accident, and we talked about this very issue. Every plan participant, the most important thing to them is getting their medical benefits paid. And every plan participant is going to trade, as Judge Posner said, that uncertain bundle of tort rights for the certainty of having their medical expenses paid up front. And I see I'm out of time. May I finish my thought? Thank you, Judge. Every person wants their medical expenses paid up front. That's the most important thing to them. Yes, Your Honor. And the Walmart plan has not said this, but I have around the country since Knutson. I've heard many health plans and spoken at industry meetings where many health plans have talked about the idea of writing out of coverage third-party accidents. If they can't come into federal court and get their money back where it's being contested, they can write this out of coverage. And there are cases that enforce that. And I think that's a strong public policy reason why instead of doing everything that can be done to discourage plans from bringing these suits, that they ought to be encouraged. Where plan participants are not going to cooperate and they're not going to pay, they ought to be encouraged to require those funds be dispersed. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
First off, the account was opened on November 14th, 2002. That was opened before any service was had on the Lefkoe complaint. That was opened before the clerk of the court even issued the notice of remandment to the state court. And, pardon me? Dating myself. You're right, Judge. Secondly, there is nothing about dissipation of the funds in the record. There is nothing about dissipation of funds in either of the Wells or the Goff cases. That's a specter that counsel raised downstairs, but the reality is there are other alternatives. And what the cases talk about when they talk about disbursement or dissipation of the funds or unavailability of the funds is there is no way to collect it. If you look at the Knutson case, they talk about the that issue. This is nothing more than the imposition of personal liability upon the plaintiff. That's what this case is about. And if he's worried about dissipation of funds, if he thinks the funds will be dissipated, then under Rule 64, he has the right of attachment, pre-judgment attachment, if he can allege and prove those elements necessary in Rule 64. And this stuff about, you know, funds won't pay, or they're talking about that, and there's nothing in a record about that. So I don't know what the funds are going to do. But I certainly object to the raising of that specter. Because in a lot of the stuff here, in a lot of the arguments and allegations of the Walmart, there just is no factual basis in the record to establish there would be any dissipation of funds or the funds wouldn't be available. The contrary is true. Thank you, Your Honor.